Sports Out of Time, Episode 4, Season 2. Randall, opening pitch. What's the craziest thing you've ever seen happen in a real sporting event?
Ooh, like on the field?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Wow. I was at a game when I was a kid. At least I remember being at this game. So hopefully I'm remembering it correctly. You know how when you're a kid, you think you did something, but you might not have. I was at a game where Andre Dawson hit 3 home runs against the Philadelphia Phillies.
Wow. Really?
And single-handedly beat the Phillies. It was like 6-3 Cubs. And I remember watching the news that night, because this is when like the regular 10 o'clock news, there's no Sports Center. Or if there was, I didn't have it. And it said, instead of Cubs 6, Phillies 3, it said Dawson 6, Phillies 3. And I thought that
was you were actually there for mine. You and I went to a Cubs game many years ago when you were living in Wrigleyville.
Yeah.
And Kerry Wood was pitching. And I think we've told the story on the podcast, so I'll go quick.
Yeah.
Kerry Wood was pitching. He got thrown out of the game for arguing balls and strikes on an obvious miscall by the umpire, and everyone in the stadium saw it except the ump. And then the center field at Wrigley started throwing garbage and bottles onto the center field. Like, they had to stop the game. They had to clean the field off. And then my favorite part about this is once they cleaned the field off and left, people started throwing more stuff on the field. And it was hilarious. I still think about that all the time. What a petty maneuver by the Cubs fans. Amazing.
Oh, you're done cleaning? Not so fast. Yeah.
And then also we almost fought that Cincinnati Reds fan at the end because he was being a jerk to a little kid.
He was being a jerk to a little kid. You know, now that you bring that up, there are other events that I'm thinking of. But, you know, I'll stick with what I said before. Because I did see Kerry Wood and Roger Clemens face off at Wrigley Field, and that was an epic game. So, you know, whatever. I'll stick with what I said.
Yeah, I saw Jeter and A-Rod home run in the same game once. That was kind of cool, but that doesn't really count. Yeah. That's just like a nice little moment. Speaking of a nice moment, let's look back at a nice moment in time here. This week on Episode 4, we're looking back at the very fascinating story of Morgana, the Kissing Bandit. I guess I should say Morgana the Kissing Bandit and other thing that we'll talk about later.
Yeah. And Friends.
And Friends. Yeah. Morgana and Friends. That's pretty good, actually. I mean, I'll use that for the title. So Randall, I'm excited to talk about Morgana. This was a story, and this happens because I do so much editing now that my brain is fried, I think. I was thinking about, right? Like, sometimes when you send me the scripts, I start thinking immediately about, like, editing and clips. I'm like, Morgana.
Like clips, right.
Yeah,
right.
Clips. Like, what am I going to do for like this? Like, you know, and I remember the Morgana thing, the story popped up and I was like, this is a weird story. I don't know about Morgana. What's Morgana's deal? And the more you talked about this story, the more I read about it, the more interested I got in this story. Like, the more fascinated I was by the character.
Yeah.
It kind of creeped up on me. So I want to shout out my friend Devin Hoffman, who sent us a autographed photo that he had of Morgana with a connection to the Utica Blue Sox that I didn't know existed. Folks who don't know, Utica Blue Sox is my local single A baseball affiliate from when I was growing up. They were around for most of the 80s and 90s in Utica. And he sent me a photo of Morgana wearing the Utica Blue Sox hat. And it's signed and it's got, you know, like it says like breast wishes or something like that. You know what I mean? Like on the thing, it's, Morgana.
I pulled it up, Sam, because you sent it to me.
Yeah, yeah.
It said, "Hi, Devin, your bosom buddy, Morgana." And and then there's a second photo that says that she explains that she was part owner of the Blue Sox.
That's right.
And I just noticed now as I'm looking at it. And you'll have to take a look. The M The M, how do I describe this? It looks...
It looks. Does it look like breasts? Is that what you were implying?
Yeah, it does. The M has two little dots on the top of each M hoop. You see it now? I didn't notice that at first, Sam.
You know, I got to give Morgana credit for knowing her audience and just really going in. Very, very great. I wanted to follow this up, though, because I did a little research after this, and I found this. This is actually an archived article called New Affection from December 18th, 1985. And it's from the New York Times about Morgana buying the Utica Blue Sox. It's actually quite fascinating. Yeah, I won't go any farther into this because there's a couple paragraphs. It's fine. But yeah, the article is called New Affection. It's an archive from the New York Times. It's worth 2.5 minutes of your time from December 18th, 1985. So thank you, Devin, for bringing this up and spending me down a rabbit hole of Morgana and the Utica Blue Sox that I did not expect to go down today.
That is awesome. And Sam, I just wanted to point out one thing before we really jump into this week's episode. Now that we're talking about minor league teams, hometown minor league teams. So the Joliet Slammers, which is an independent Frontier League team, was just purchased by a group that consists of Bill Murray.
Yep.
And I'm not making this up. Bill Murray and Mike Vec, who is, I believe, the grandson of Bill Vec. He's in the Vec family. So we're pretty excited because that can only be positive.
Bill Murray weirdly has another one who has a weird connection to the Utica Blue Sox for some reason. The Utica Blue Sox, I don't know what they were up to. They had weird connections in the 70s and 80s with like celebrities and B-list stars. I don't know what they were trying to do. Very strange.
Yeah, very, very strange.
I love minor. We should do it. One of these days, we'll do a whole episode on like minor league baseball, because minor league baseball is a whole different stratosphere from like anything else we talk about.
Absolutely.
But speaking of today's story, Morgana, it was a little hard for me to actually find a date. So I settled on April 15th, 1969, which is sometime in the middle of the first month that she made her first appearance.
Yes.
That seems fair.
Yeah, seems fair.
So let's take you back on our pop culture time machine to April 15th, 1969. As you drove your car to the movie theater, you could pop in and see the number one movie in America, the 1969 American road drama film, Easy Rider.
This year, the judges of the Cannes Film Festival presented the award Best Film by a New Director to Easy Rider. It's the story of a man who went looking for America and couldn't find it anywhere. Easy Rider stars Peter Fonda.
It's not every man that can live off the land, you know?
Yeah, Easy Rider, written by Peter Fonda, starring Dennis Hopper, Peter Fonda, and Jack Nicholson. Fonda and Hopper play two bikers who travel through the American Southwest and South, carrying the proceeds from a cocaine deal. The success of Easy Rider helped to spark the new Hollywood era of filmmaking. I'm embarrassed, as a guy who loves movies and movie culture, that I've actually never seen this movie, because I feel like I should have. Have you seen this movie, Randall?
You know what? I was going to say, I've seen bits and pieces of it, but I've never sat and watched the whole thing from start to finish. So I'm embarrassed as well.
A little embarrassed because you know, this is considered a landmark counterculture film. It's a touchstone of a generation. It explores societal landscape, issues and tensions about adolescence in the U.S., especially during the 60s with hippie movement, drug use, and the ideas of a more communal lifestyle. Also, famously, this movie uses real marijuana in the scenes where they're smoking weed and other substances, which is hilarious to me. So if you watch those scenes where Dennis Hopper and Nicholson are like ranting and smoking weed, that's just them ranting and smoking weed. That's the new cinema for you.
They're not scared of you.
They're scared of what you represent to them.
Amen.
All we represent to them, man, is somebody who needs a haircut.
Oh, no. What you represent to them is freedom.
What the hell's wrong with freedom, man? That's what it's all about.
Easy Rider earned $60 million worldwide from a modest budget of $400,000. It also received two Academy Award nominations for Best Original Screenplay and Best Supporting Actor for Jack Nicholson. In 1998, this film was selected for preservation in the National Film Registry for the Library of Congress, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. So yeah, there's a lot of famous movies from that era that get pulled into the registry. The one I always think of is like King Kong, like 1930s, like that. That's one that's always in there, like culturally significant.
And you've got, you know, now I'm going to go blank.
There's so many movies. There's a million movies.
There are.
So many. Yeah. Casablanca, you know, like anything.
Thank you.
Like,
that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. Citizen Kane, stuff like that. Right.
Yeah.
This film received mostly positive reviews from critics at the time. Vincent Canby of the New York Times called it, quote unquote, lowercase cinema, despite the uppercase statement about our society, which is sick. So I think that because this is like a counterculture movie, you're going to have like more traditional critics be like, I don't know about this film. You're right.
For sure.
This is a movie that's more important in hindsight, I think, than it is immediately when it comes out because of what it foreshadows for what these movies are going to become. He did praise the photography, the rock and roll score, and of course, Jack Nicholson's performance. Roger Ebert didn't record this didn't review this at the time, although he did add it to his list of great movies that he made in 2004.
Okay.
So there you are, Easy Rider. Now, I imagine if you're going to see Easy Rider, you probably partook in a little substance of your own, since this is one of those kind of movies. So maybe you get out of the movie and you get back in your car and you think maybe something is wrong with you because you turn on the radio and listen to the weirdest number one song that we have ever talked about on this show. That's right. The song In the Year 2525, parentheses, Exordium and Terminus, unparentheses, by Zagar and Evans.
In the year 3535, ain't gonna need to tell the truth, tell no lies. Everything you think, do, and say is in the pill you took today. In the year 4545, ain't gonna need your teeth, won't need your eyes. You won't find a thing to chew. Nobody's gonna look.
What the hell is this? This is the most confusing song. I can't stand this song. Were you familiar with this song before we talked about it? Do you know anything about this song?
Nothing. I no memory of this whatsoever.
This is one of the most batshit crazy songs that's ever existed in the history of music, in my opinion. I remember this from when I was a kid. So In the Year 2525 is a 1969 song by the rock pop duo known as Zagar and Evans. It was originally recorded by a small regional label in 1968, but then it gets picked up by RCA. These guys disbanded in 1971. So mind you, they're going to be gone in a few years from here.
Yeah.
This is not to knock them, by the way. This is just to make it clear that because of that, they never really released another charting single, which effectively made them one-hit wonders. What's interesting about that is this occurred in both the United States on the Billboard Top 100 and in the UK, where it also went to number one. And as of 2022, it is the only artist to ever have a chart-topping number one hit on both sides of the Atlantic and never to have another single for the rest of their career.
Wow.
Yeah, kind of wild, right?
Yeah.
Another crazy thing about this song, it was recorded primarily in one take in 1968 in a studio in a cow pasture in Odessa, Texas. This song, this batshit song, is essentially, it's a story. The song opens with a verse explaining that if mankind has survived to this point, it would witness the subsequent events of the song. So every verse is like, in the year 2525, in the year 3535, 4545, 55, blah, 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 on and on and on, all the way until 95, 95. I don't really think there's a chorus. I think they just repeat the same part over and over again from 25, 25 to 95, 95. So there you go. That's the whole song. The following verses jump the story again, 1,000-year intervals. And each millennium, life becomes increasingly sedentary and automated. Thoughts are pre-programmed into pills for people to consume. Eyes, teeth, limbs all lose their purpose due to machines replacing their function. Marriage becomes obsolete because children are now conceived in test tubes. What is happening? I'm so confused. I mean, spot on, I guess, but still, Like what?
In some ways, yeah.
In some ways, yeah. Song ends after 10,000 years. By that time, humans have finally become extinct. The overriding theme of a world doomed by its passive acquiescence to and overdependence on its own overdone technology, all while neglecting the unchecked exploitation of the Earth, struck a resonant chord with millions of people around the world in the late 1960s and also 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, and 2020s.
Now it's been 10,000 years, man has cried a billion tears for what he never knew. Now man's reign is through, but through eternal night, the twinkling of starlight, so very far away, maybe it's only yesterday. In the
year I'm stunned. I don't know what people were doing in 1969. What was happening here? What was going on?
Well, I think that they were all probably just smoking the marijuana, just like they were an Easy Rider.
Easy Rider.
Everyone was doing that. And this is what came of it musically, right?
Oh, my God. Yeah. In the year 20. What an awful song. What just an absolute terrible, terrible song. All right. So after listening to that acid trip of a song and watching that forefront of new Hollywood cinema, it's time to go home and settle in to the number one book in America, The Love Machine. That's right, The Love Machine, the second novel by Jacqueline Suzanne, the follow-up to her enormously successful novel from 1966, Valley of the Dolls. Love Machine tells the story of a ruthless, haunted Robin Stone and his career in life in the cutthroat world of 1960s television. The title of the book refers not, of course, just to the character Robin Stone, but to the television set itself. Suzanne claimed... Okay. Yeah, Suzanne's got some thoughts about this.
Right.
The title has a dual meaning, she says. The man is like a machine, and so is the television box. A machine selling the love of the actors and the love of the sponsors. Critical reception of The Love Machine was not positive, but it was slightly better than that of Valley of the Dolls, which, again, was a huge hit, even despite its poor reviews, right? Christopher Lehman Haupt of the New York Times wrote the novel is, quote, popcorn, the kernel of an idea, the seed of an inspiration, exploding into bite-sized nothingness. That's actually a nice little quote there. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
1971, there is a film based on the novel, directed by Jack Haley Jr. It stars John Philip Law, Diane Cannon, Robert Ryan, Jackie Cooper, and David Hemmings.
What is that?
An ankh. It's the ancient Egyptian symbol for love and life forever. If you ever need me, you'll find me. I just want to make life easy for you. I'm in love with him, Jerry.
He's a loner. And he's a killer.
They call him The Love Machine.
What do you do for him besides get him girls?
You want to be my girl?
Oh, yes. Yes, Robin.
No strings, no promises.
Interestingly enough, Jacqueline Suzanne receives $1.5 million, which is about 11.
Wow.
Yeah. 11.3 in 2022 money for the film rights to this book. So this is a record sum for an author to receive for the rights to a book. Jeez. At the time.
Yeah.
She also has a brief cameo in the film, which is something I feel like all authors want to do. They want like one cameo like in their novel just to show up for a second. Reviews of this film, much like the novel, are mostly negative. Roger Ebert writing, John Philip Law is pretty bored in The Love Machine. He plays an artifact only slightly more animated than the monolith in 2001, A Space Odyssey.
You know, it's interesting. In the late 60s, there was obviously they're concerned about technology, right? And its implication moving forward. And, you know, rightfully so. And there, it's not, that's certainly not the first time anyone's ever written about technology kind of, you know, ruining humanity, but it does seem to be at the forefront.
Well, I think we go through, you know, every time new technology enters our lives, like even right now, as we sit here on Zoom talking to each other, right? Like we accept new technology into our lives pretty readily. Like it's one of those things, like we just incorporate it and don't always think of the consequences. And usually after we do that, there is a backlash to technology. Like once every house in America has a television, you're going to start to see people look at it and go, huh, I wonder if there's some things we didn't think about, right? About the, the other side effects of what these do to us. And it makes sense that the narratives and like the, you know, the pop culture at the time is flowing in that direction as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
All right, Randall, that's all I have for the pop culture time machine. But I think you have something that you want to share with us today.
I do, Sam. It's a new segment, at least for now. We're trying it out. It's called Trivia Out of Time. It's just a simple trivia question. It really doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what you're about to hear the rest of the episode, but something to think about, and we'll come back to at the end.
Sure.
And so, Sam, I'm really asking you this question and all the listeners, but you'll actually have a chance to try to answer the question at the end of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
So for our first Trivia Out of Time with Randall question, here you go. What is regarded as the first mascot in Major League Baseball?
Ooh. So I did look at this question when you put it in here, and I will tell you that I did not look up any answers. I did have a discussion with a friend of mine where we talked about what we thought the answers could be. So I do have an answer in my head that I think it might be, but I did not check it. So I want you to know that. Honest Eagle, I promise.
I believe you, and we'll let you answer this question on the other side.
Beautiful. So why don't we start our journey today? Episode 4, Season 2. Today, we're going to talk about Morgana, the Kissing Bandit, and then for some reason, a big crab. A big crab.
During the 80s there and 90s, there was a woman who used to run onto the field, and I saw this in Major League Baseball stadiums, and she would run onto the field and kiss random baseball players. And today, that's the story I want to tell. It's the story of Morgana, the Kissing Bandit. Do you remember Morgana?
So, because I was born in the 1980s, I was born in 1986. My recollection and knowledge of Morgana the Kissing Bandit is mostly the pop culture reference of her as a figure from old baseball. I don't know that I ever remember it being a thing that I actively saw, although I do have to shout out a listener here, GFOP to the podcast, Devin Hoffman, good time friend, sent us a message after I posted a picture of the sneak preview for this episode and said, he had sent out a picture to Morgana a few weeks ago because he found that she had been to a Utica Blue Sox game and taken a photo there, and he had the photo. So he sent it out to her, and it turns out he just got the photo back last week with her autograph on it. So he sent me a picture of the autographed. Yeah, not even. Yeah, no joke. Crazy. So the Utica Blue Sox connection with Morgana the Kissing Bandit is indeed real for us upstate New Yorkers.
There you go. So, yeah. So we're going to have some. We already have a fan out there.
We already have one fan. One fan is
looking
excited
forward to this story. So.
Shout out to Devin.
Excellent. Well, let's get right into it, Sam, since you don't know too much about it. So Morgana Roberts, also known as Morgana the Kissing Bandit, was an entertainer who became famous for running onto the field and kissing baseball players and other athletes from 1969, which I had no idea it started that early, to 1999, which I had no idea it had gone on that long. She was also a successful exotic dancer who used her humor, which I didn't know of either, and curves to wow the audiences. Her life story is pretty remarkable, and it's full of adventure, comedy, and controversy. I actually think she missed her calling as a comedian. I think she probably would have been even more successful if she had followed comedy as her life's passion.
Well, in this world, we all try to carve niches leading to something concrete in life. Take little old country girl Morgana from Kentucky. She parlayed a unique figure, great daring and speed, in her now infamous act called Morgana the Kissing Bandit. She kisses unsuspecting athletes and then runs away into the night. She's in town for a promotion, and she wanted to catch our Paul Douglas off guard, and she did.
She's very quick-witted, so...
Yeah, very funny.
Some of her... her quotes that we'll get into are just hilarious. So Morgana was born on July 4th, 1947, Louisville, Kentucky. She was a baseball fan from a young age as her grandfather took her to see the Louisville team, a minor league team, when she grew up in a poor family. Her mother, Jane, disowned Morgana as a baby, which led to her grandmother, Virginia's, taking care of Morgana for 6 years. And Morgana was then sent to Mount Mercy Catholic Boarding School just outside of Louisville. Now, she initially wanted to be a nun, which seems ridiculous at this point, but ran away from the school at the age of 13, hitchhiking with a friend to Baltimore, where she begged shop owners for a job while living on the street and eating out of garbage cans at the age of 13.
This was in Louisville, Kentucky, her hometown. Morgana didn't enjoy her time there and ran away from it a year after starting at age 13. She then hitchhiked with one of her friends to Baltimore, where she lived homeless for a period of time. During this time period, she subsisted off of scraps from local shop owners, as well as food she foraged out of dumpsters behind local restaurants. She would have worked a traditional job, but she found out she was too young to receive a work permit.
As somebody who has worked in education before and has worked with people of very, very intense levels of poverty, growing up in this kind of situation where you are living on the street and eating what you can find, it is an almost unsustainable style where lifestyle where it feels like there is no way out. So knowing where the story goes, it's amazing that she was able to accomplish what she was able to from where she started. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So after a month, Morgana came across an ad in the window of the Flamingo Club for a cigarette girl or camera girl, but must be 18 years of age. So she told the owner she was 18, and he quickly decided that she would be better employed as an exotic dancer. Again, she's 13. Okay. So the story, and this was the 60s.
Such a mess.
Okay. So at 13, she was passing for an 18-year-old, and Morgana had no idea what that was because she was 13, but she said yes, thinking it had something to do with a camel and veils. Because that's what a 13-year-old should think an exotic dancer is, right?
It's exotic. It's exotic cultures and such. Yeah, right. It's very exotic.
So her first appearance on stage did not go well. I can't imagine how it would. She could not walk in her high heels, and as she danced, the men in the audience kept shouting, "Take it off." Again, 13 years old. They didn't know she was 13, but she's 13.
Can I break up a point here? One of the things I saw during the research here, and you might think to yourself, how is it possible that somebody would think that a girl who's that young is older than that? The reality is this. You've seen the pictures. Morgana was born with very, very large breasts. So large, in fact, that most people assume she was considerably older than she was at the time. Yeah,
absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. So in case you were curious how people were so confused, that did play a part in whatever confusion these men were feeling.
And of course, I'm sure the owner of the Flamingo Club, where they do have exotic dancers, wasn't exactly the most.
Yeah, historically club owners.
Speaking,
I
don't know this owner. I can't speak for his morals, but you know, just historically speaking. Yeah. So as the audience kept shouting, "Take it off," she thought they were referring to her, like get off the stage. So she burst into tears and had to be led off the stage by the manager. But after watching some of the other performers, she soon got the hang of it and was a well-established and successful exotic dancer by the time she was 17 years old. Her act combined stripping with comedy, wearing 2 10-gallon cowboy hats on her chest, and impersonating the film critic Gene Shalit.
Okay, so hang on a second. Is something that I saw in here. Now, you'll have to correct me because that's been a long time. Gene Shalit's the guy with the mustache, and he's like, "Hi, I'm Gene Shalit." Is he that guy? Is that who he is?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
Oh, look what you did, Peter.
I can't help it. I haven't been this scared since I was mugged by Gene Shalit.
Don't panic, Room. I'm not going to William Hurt you. I only want your tango in cash. So just pay it forward, and we'll all be Happy Gilmore.
What?
So cowboy hat on her chest.
Two cowboy hats. 10 gallon.
And Jean Shatt. This is a very niche performance. This is a very,
I have no idea how Jean Shalit worked into this performance,
I'm so
but I kind of want to see it. I mean, right? I mean, don't you kind of want to see how that played out?
I'm morbidly curious at where the Jean Shalit can. The Jean Shalit thing is going to stick with me for the rest of the day. I'm going to keep thinking about it for the next week and a half. I can see it already.
Yeah, absolutely. So while on stage, she avoided singing, however, as she said, when I sing, people think the place is being raided.
Yeah.
So that's just a glimpse into her humor. So she attracted particular attention from what the writer Hank Davis describes as her ample physical development, which you just referred to. Simply put, the woman makes Dolly Parton look developmentally delayed. So Morgana gave her measurements as 60, 23, 39, which
outrageous.
The 60 inch chest, 23 inch waist, 39 inch hips. That's how it works, right? Which she referred to as her baseball stats.
Hi-oh. She's funny. You gotta give her, she really is funny every time you listen. She's very funny.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So Morgana required a custom built brassiere, and I'm not making this up. It was an I cup. So an I cup, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I is, I, you know, I don't wear brassieres, but I'm pretty sure that's how it works.
Yeah. Female, female GFOPs. If you want to let us know what an I cup is in relation to something else or what that means, help us out. Cause as men, we kind of have a vague idea of what that means, but I would say vague is the best possible description of that scenario. Yeah.
So she frequently told anyone who would listen that Dolly Parton was flat chested compared to her. Poor Dolly is just getting piled on here.
a lot of drive-bys on Dolly Parton here today.
Well, I guess it's because Dolly was known as being very well endowed up top, right?
Quite voluptuous, that Dolly Parton.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So she frequently told people that Dolly Parton was flat chested, including as a guest on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. So basically to the world at that point.
Oh, we are having such a good time.
It was funny from the first show on. It's only getting better.
Yeah, and you never know. You know, you do a lot of pilots and you throw them out and you hope for the best. And then all of a sudden, it began to kind of fall together.
Yeah.
And working with those other three ladies is
Rue McClanahan and Bea Arthur.
And Estelle Getty.
And Estelle Getty. I mean, that's a good cast.
And now, Bea is 9.5 feet tall. And has a voice deeper than Ed's.
Yeah.
And is an absolute bowl of jello before she goes on.
So Morgana's career as the Kissing Bandit began in August of 1969. After receiving a dare from one of her friends, Morgana took to the stage at a baseball game and kissed one of the players. The game is at Crowley Field in Cincinnati, and the player that Morgana dares to steal a kiss from is none other than Pete Rose. Now, Rose was starring in commercials for Ballpark Franks at the time, so Morgana told him she bought the hot dogs he promoted before giving him a quick kiss on the cheek. Rose called her crazy and told her she was going to get in trouble. She didn't. Her mission complete, Morgana hustled back toward her friends, hopped over the fence, and returned to her seat. No security, no arrest.
Yeah, absolutely stunning.
So she and her friends watched the rest of the game without incident.
Well, so I guess, okay, two things that come to my mind first here. One, I guess I'm not saying that in 1969 anyone could have done this. Maybe it's just one of those things. It seems pretty innocuous here, even just in the story. I think this is also the point in time in the story where we should say, and again, I'm not making any sort of claims one way or the other. If this was a man who did this, he would be arrested and tackled immediately. No, correct?
Well, yes, absolutely. In 1969, if a gentleman tried to run onto the field and kiss a baseball player,
he's probably getting tackled.
Yeah, he's gonna get tackled. So So this, and this is a great quote from Morgana. Well, I'll get to it in a second, but the next day, a Cincinnati sports writer dubbed her the Kissing Bandit. So she, that's when she became the Kissing Bandit. They didn't know her name was Morgana at that point. In later years, Morgana liked to say that her career began with a bet and Pete Rose's ended with one.
See, she's got jokes. I like it. I like it. She's got jokes.
She's got jokes. She's not just running out there kissing willy-nilly. She's got jokes with them.
Is there a less like fun-loving baseball player than Pete Rose, by the way? Could they brought Ty Cobb back from the dead to be a less likable baseball player?
You know, I left tickets for Bill Buckner, but he couldn't bend over to pick them up.
Man,
how about it?
Speaking of the World Series and the great tradition here in Boston with the Red Sox.
Well, they call it the curse of the Bambino. Right here. The city of losers.
Easy.
Kings, how about you help? It?
Did you prep Pete Rose?
Well, we did have a couple of photos made.
Well, you know, it sounds like he handled it pretty well.
Yeah, he seemed like he was all right with it. Yeah.
But because there are other players, as the story goes on, that did not handle it quite so well as Pete Rose.
For sure.
So Morgana enjoyed the thrill of kissing Pete Rose so much that she decided to make it a regular hobby. Mm-hmm. Why not? So she started traveling around the country, following different baseball teams and picking out her targets. She usually chose players who were popular or had some kind of record or achievement, right? So she also preferred players who were married, as she thought it would be more fun to make their wives jealous. She claimed she never kissed anyone who didn't want to be kissed, and that most players were flattered by her attention. Again, this was starting in 1969, right? So I don't think it was, nobody was, you know, I'm sure wives would get upset, right?
It seems like enough of a gimmick or enough of a bit where people were in on the joke, right? People were in on this joke. It's not I feel like I was just thinking the same thing. Like after the first time, after people are aware of it, now it is almost like an honor if she comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, I mean, Pete Rose, I mean, he's obviously one of the best baseball players of all time in the late 60s for sure. So, yeah, if you were chosen at this point, you would accomplish something as a player. It's like a rite of passage. So, like I said, Morgana's kisses were not always welcomed, however. Some players tried to avoid her, some were angry with her, and some even sued her. For example, Steve Sachs of the Los Angeles Dodgers filed a $1 million lawsuit against her in 1988, claiming that she caused him emotional distress and invaded his privacy. The suit was later dismissed by a judge who said it was frivolous and a waste of time.
What seems to be the problem, officers?
It's enough out of you, smart guy.
Reach for your license. Slowly.
Well, well. Steve Sachs from New York City.
I heard some guy got killed in New York City and they never solved the case. But you wouldn't know anything about that now, would you, Steve?
But there's hundreds of unsolved murders in New York City.
You don't know when to keep your mouth shut, do you, sexy boy?
Morgana also faced legal consequences for her actions. She was arrested several times for trespassing, disorderly conduct, and assault, including in Houston in 1985, after running onto the field and kissing Astros pitcher Nolan Ryan and shortstop Dickie Thon. She successfully used a gravity defense, claiming in court that the physics caused her to fall over an Astrodome fence, trying to catch a foul ball and onto the playing surface.
Can I just say, that's pretty dangerous, because the last person I remember who tried to rush at Nolan Ryan was Robin Ventura, and we all remember how that turned out, and it was not great for him.
Ventura hit in the right elbow up. And all of a sudden, Ventura raced to the mound. Ryan hogtied him. There were some punches thrown. They went down, and the crowd will be in this one the rest of the way. John Russell is being held back by Tom Henke, and we'll see what the umpires do. Ryan has his jersey ripped. He comes out of it all right.
No, that didn't work. But thankfully, Nolan did not do that to Morgana. So while using the gravity defense, Morgana says, "Who's going to argue?" she asked. who's going to argue with Isaac Newton? So she usually got away with a fine or a warning, but sometimes she had to spend a night or two in jail. One time she was intercepted by security before she could smooch Cubs second baseman Ryan Sandberg in the first night game at Wrigley Field in 1988 and spent some time in the unfriendly confines of a Chicago jail. But the truth is, no jail could hold her. This may have literally been so, and she never suffered serious legal trouble. She said she did not mind the arrests as they gave her more publicity and increased her popularity, turning Morgana into a C-list celebrity who autographed glossy photographs of herself with the phrase, "Breast wishes."
You got to have a slogan.
Did your buddy get one of those?
That's a good question. Let me see if I can get, I don't have my phone on me. I'm going to see if I can see it on my watch. Let me find out. What does it say?
Because that would be incredible if it did say breast wishes.
It says, "Hi, Devin, your bosom buddy, Morgana." Oh.
Yes.
Yes.
Amazing. Morgana is still bringing it.
I love it.
2023.
She's still got that heat. Still got the heat.
You gotta love it. So Morgana branched out into the NBA and other sports as well. Planting a kiss on Charles Barkley in 1989, she found himself staring deeply into her eye cups. "He kept talking to my cleavage while I kissed him," she said.
I hope there's footage of this.
Morgana Roberts, the kissing bandit, surprises Charles Barkley.
She also kissed hockey players, football players, golfers, and even NASCAR drivers. She once tried to kiss a horse at the Kentucky Derby, but was stopped by security. Now, Morgana appeared on numerous talk shows, magazines, and commercials. She even had a cameo in the movie Kingpin. I don't know That's if right. you've seen that cameo.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where she played herself as a bowling fan who kisses Woody Harrelson's character. So I encourage everyone to watch Kingpin because I love Kingpin.
Yeah, yeah. I'll see if I can find that clip here for you. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And even just to watch it for Morgana. Really.
Left hand, and notice how carefully he places it in the prosthetic hand.
You have no idea the pressure that's... Oh!
Look at that!
Oh, give us a break.
Oh, look at Big Earn, Chris. Look at Big Earn. Calls her back. How gallant is that?
This man's going to win a lot of political offices when his career is over.
A great role model.
She also continued her dancing career, earning up to $5,000 a night and performing in front of crowds of thousands. She was known as Morgana the Wild One as a dancer and often wore costumes that matched the theme of the city or event she was visiting. The kissing bandit reportedly earned millions from her fame. She was featured on her very own bubblegum card set, which I wish I had one of. At one point, she owned part of a minor league baseball team.
Hmm.
Other minor league teams invited her to games to kiss their players, which boosted attendances. And when Morgana wasn't earning thousands of dollars per week as an exotic dancer, she was making public appearances at events and conventions.
Well, the interesting thing I'm thinking about is after, you know, again, we talked about early on, you have a little legal trouble here and there. You have a little bit of people giving you a hard time. But at some point in time, almost everywhere she goes, people sort of know the character. She probably gets to a point where people are just sort of like, yep, let's do it. Let's go.
I think so. Okay. Yeah. Morgana's here. Something's going to happen.
Yeah, for sure.
We just don't know when and who.
Yeah, exactly.
I think so. Right? Right?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
So Morgana retired from kissing in 1999 after kissing more than 50 athletes over 3 decades. At the time, she wanted to pursue a normal life and spend more time with her husband, whom she married in 1986. Her husband was a former minor league baseball player and a car salesman, and he supported Morgana's kissing career and often accompanied her to the games. He even helped her plan some of her kisses, such as one with Cal Ripken Jr., which he suggested as a birthday present for Morgana.
It looks like Morgana has made her way onto the field.
How can you tell?
She's not after Jose, is she? She's got to be looking for Cal.
Morgana also retired from dancing in 2000 after performing for more than 40 years. She said she wanted to pursue other interests such as painting, gardening, and writing. And Morgana has since split with that husband.
Yeah.
The two are together for over 25 years. And we haven't seen Morgana since 1999, nor has she done an interview since the turn of the millennium.
Yeah.
She has repeatedly declined interview requests from Sports Illustrated and reportedly from Playboy, for whom she was a centerfold in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
Her message when asked for interviews is, "I just get sick of talking about myself and always being the center of attention." She added, "Morgana has left the building."
I kind of appreciate that, actually. You know, some folks who, you know, you get that moment of celebrity and you're just following it for the rest of your life. I kind of appreciate when somebody's like, "Nah, I think I'm good. I think I'm done now."
Yeah. I often wonder that about a lot of famous people,
yeah.
Especially, I mean, you see, it's like they're always just, I'm sure it's addictive, right? That mm-hmm. fame. But yeah, you see, and you're like, why don't you just go and retire and live? But hey, you know, it's up to them. So here's some of Morgana's most famous kisses. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
George Brett, she kissed him twice, once in 1975 and again in 1985. The first time, Brett was so surprised that he fell down on his back and had to be helped up by his teammates. The second time, yeah, I think a little bit.
The
second time, he was more prepared and even gave her a hug before she ran away. We mentioned Nolan Ryan. She kissed him in 1980 after he threw his fifth no-hitter. Ryan was not amused and said he would have preferred a plaque or a trophy instead. He seems a little kind of straight-laced and, you know, a little conservative for Morgana, right?
I might reinsert the clip of him beating up Robin Ventura again.
Streak after a single early, and the pitch is way in. It hit him in the right elbow. He's going to the mound. He's going after Nolan Ryan. Ventura against Ryan. They've got him bear hugged. Ventura fighting Ryan. Ryan being pushed back. Both benches empty. A huge brawl has erupted as Robin Ventura has chased the legend Nolan Ryan, and the Rangers take exception.
Cal Ripken Jr., she kissed him in 1990 during his record-breaking streak of consecutive games played. Ripken later said that he thought it was his wife coming to congratulate him until he saw Morgana's face. I don't know what Cal Ripken's wife looked like, but I would have thought something else would have registered that it wasn't his wife before her face.
You would think so. I've never seen his wife. Who's to say?
Exactly. So I don't know. Johnny Bench, she kissed mm-hmm. him in 1977 during his last game before retirement.
Mm-hmm.
That's a retirement gift. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, she kissed him in 1988 during his last NBA game. Another retirement gift.
Do you think she needed a step stool? Do you think she had to get up on something to kiss Kareem, or he bent over?
I think he bent over.
Yeah, bent over.
Charles Barkley. Mm-hmm. She kissed him in 1990 during a basketball game between the Sixers and the Spurs. Steve Garvey, she kissed him in 1978 during the World Series. Garvey was so startled that he dropped his glove and had to chase after it. I don't know. I'll have to look up that clip. I don't know what have to.
Yeah,
chase
I've never
after
seen.
His
yeah,
glove.
Never seen. Yeah.
I mean, did it roll away? It wasn't the ball. Yeah,
he threw it away by accident, probably.
I guess. Tom Seaver, she kissed him in 1983 after he won his 300th game. And Len Barker, she kissed him in 1981 after he pitched a perfect game. Barker said that he was more nervous about Morgana than the game, as he had heard rumors that she was coming for him.
I like the idea, like the Jaws theme song playing in his head just the whole time, waiting for her to like come out of somewhere.
Is that the kissing bandit? That's Morgana. Has kissed George Brett, Frank Howard, a number of others, with all the security in this ballpark. Many of it was Secret Service people, local police for the vice president. She somehow got through. Bob Hope enjoying it. The commissioners are having a meeting and Bob Hope's laughing. That tells you something.
So I think we talked about this. I don't think we'll ever see another Morgana, the Kissing Bandit, or any sort of Kissing Bandit with security and player safety being what it is today.
No.
I
mean,
I can't imagine anything like this happening now or in the future, right? Morgana's retirement was literally the end of an era, I would imagine. I don't know if you saw earlier this year, there was a guy who ran onto Dodger Stadium, ran onto the field to like propose to his girlfriend, I believe fiance now. And he was just completely leveled by security.
I did see that. Yeah.
Did you see that one? And all he ran on, went to drop to one knee and was asking her, you know, obviously to marry him, but yeah, he got leveled. You know, things have changed, right? I mean, we've talked about in previous podcasts with Monica Seles, right?
Monica Seles, yeah.
And then Tom Gamboa of the Royals being attacked at Comiskey Park, U.S. Cellular Field, whatever it was at the time, in Chicago. So you just can't let it happen anymore.
So when I was trying to do my like supplemental research here for this week's episode, I had a really hard time trying to find a connecting thread, because we were saying I'm not exactly sure how we would quantify Morgana the Kissing Bandit in the history of sports personalities. So in the middle of my struggles, I reached out to our third host. That's right. Our third host, ChatGPT, to help us out. Him, who are some other non-sports personalities who are similar to Morgana the Kissing Bandit? Okay, this is where I think we've tested the limits of what AI can do here, folks. I just want you to know that. So here's what our third host said. While there isn't an exact replica of Morgana, there have been other individuals known for unconventional actions or behaviors in various realms. The first is someone I've never heard of. A Spanish gentleman known as Jimmy Jump. Randall, you ever heard of Jimmy Jump?
Jimmy Jump? No, never.
So Jimmy Jump is a notorious pitch invader known for interrupting various sporting events, including soccer matches and Formula One races. I assume he's like a Spanish streaker specifically, right?
Okay.
Yeah. They also just say streakers and pitch invaders. There have been numerous streakers and pitch invaders who disrupt sporting events. So kind of vague. Number three. David, the father of streaking zinc. That's right, David Robert Zinc, a man known for popularizing streaking as a form of public nudity in protest during the 1970s. So now ChatGPT has moved all the way away from sports. And then number four, they said, I swear to God, this is real. Our third host said, Howard Stern.
Howard Stern?
I don't know why. So I realized that our friend ChatGPT was having a hard time here. So I asked it a second question, which was, what are some examples of fans entering the field of play during a game? And this is what goes into what you were talking about, why we'll never see this again. Because every time a fan enters the field in the modern era, it usually ends poorly or leads to something bad that happens. Again, here's some of the most obvious examples. Number one, Malice at the Palace, 2004, Pacers and Detroit Pistons. Yep. Fan throws a cup at Artest. Artest goes into the crowd. One of the ugliest moments in NBA history that I can remember.
If Wallace is ejected, I'm not sure. He'd have to walk past the Pacer bench to go. Now Artest has jumped over the scorer's table and is trying to get down to the bench. Artest is in the stands. Oh, this is awful. Fans are getting involved. Steven Jackson's in the fans. Rasheed Wallace going into the stands. The security trying to somehow restore order. Fans and players are going at it, and the players trying to help each other out.
Number two, during the UEFA Euro 2016 finals between Portugal and France, a man ran onto the pitch attempting to approach Cristiano Ronaldo. He was removed from the field. That was live on television. Big deal. Ronaldo, huge star. People didn't like it. Number three, Holyfield Tyson, which is Holyfield Tyson 2, 1997.
This doesn't really have anything to do with fans. This is just him getting his ear bit off. But fans and officials did enter the ring at the end as there was sort of a riot and everything spiraled out of control.
Okay.
The one that I think of that he actually got right here is number four. And you talked about this before. 2002, Chicago White Sox, Kansas City Royals. During a Major League Baseball game, a father and son pair attacked a Kansas City Royals first base coach, Tom Gamboa. This unprovoked assault shocked the sports community and highlighted the need for increased security measures. I do think that was a big moment in terms of how we looked at fan and player interactions, that particular moment in 2002.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't, because you recall when I'm sure you've seen the video.
Yeah.
Because you weren't alive when Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's record and he was running the bases and there's fans running with him. You know, there came a point where the fans weren't going on just to celebrate with the team or a player or just to be a spectacle in and of themselves. They started to, and Morgana obviously was approaching players and touching them, but not in a violent way, but it could turn violent so quickly and easily, and it did. And now you have to assume anyone who runs onto any sport field is going to be violent, right? You have to.
Yeah, we've lost the ability to give people the benefit of the doubt when it comes to this kind of thing now because of moments like this. The only one I want to say that I do want to shout out, 2009, one of my favorite fan invasion stories of all time. A League Cup tie between lower level Barnsley and Manchester United. Two fans run onto the pitch and take the ball from young goalie Ben Foster. They pass the ball around Foster, kick it into the goal, and run off the pitch to cheering support from the fans as these pitch invaders score a goal on Ben Foster. Good stuff.
Yeah. See, that's again, that's just for fun.
I really enjoyed learning about this because, again, as I mentioned, Morgana, one of those things that I only knew through like pop culture osmosis, just showing up in like the episode of a show or mentioned somewhere or joke on The Simpsons or something along those lines.
Yeah. It was just an interesting time in sports when this could happen and an interesting character that could make it happen too, right?
Yeah.
Because you're obviously there's no guy could have done it, but I don't even know how many other women could have gotten away with it. You know what I'm saying?
No, I think you're right. I think that's fair. Yeah,
exactly.
You know, I will say something though, and I don't know how excited you are about this, but while I was doing my research for this, I kind of accidentally got into a bit of a pigeonhole. Because I was like, well, is Morgana kind of like a mascot? I started falling down the mascot train.
Okay.
I know we started talking about Morgana here, but I stumbled across something in my research that I felt we needed to discuss. So I know that we just spent 35 minutes on Morgana, but I know we have a couple minutes here to finish up. Do you have a few minutes to talk about the San Francisco Crazy Crab? Are you aware of who the San Francisco Crazy Crab is?
I am not at all familiar with the San Diego Crazy Crab.
All the fans of Giants Land love that Crazy Crab. Ooh, love that Crazy Crab. Up by the bay, the folks all say, love that Crazy Crab. Ooh, love that Crazy Crab.
I'm going to do some very, very, very brief backstory here for you folks.
Sure.
I like to just get to it. All right. So we're going back to San Francisco, the San Francisco Giants, 1984. Now, I was not yet born. I was minus two. But for folks who were alive at that time, you would have known that in 1984, things were not looking good for the San Francisco Giants. They are the 25th anniversary. They're celebrating 25 years of moving to Candlestick Park, one of the most famous stadiums of that era. Candlestick Park, real hard hit home run, a lot of wins, I remember. They have not made the playoffs since 1971, and in 1983, they slipped to a worst in baseball record of 66-96. Season before, the team sort of wanted to do something nice for all these fans who had to deal with the crummy weather in that stadium and had to sit there for extra inning games. So they gave them this pin, the Croy the Candlestick. It was a special pin for fans. It was like a little giveaway for the fans who would sit through, right? This sets the scene for the 1984 season with a great tagline for the season. The season's tagline last year in Candlestick Park is just hang in there.
When asked to describe his job, Gallagher was known to put it simply, "I was supposed to get butts in the seats any way possible." In an effort to get said butts in said seats, he was more than willing to concoct ever more ridiculous marketing schemes for the club. It was Gallagher who, spurred on by Candlestick Park's miserable reputation, introduced the Croy de Candlestick, a pin that would be given to any fan who stayed through the end of an extra inning night game. Emblazoned on the bottom were the words, "Veni, Vidi, Vixi." I came, I saw, I survived.
That's the tagline. I love it. So the president of the Giants, of Giants Enterprises, is this guy named Pat Gallagher. And he talks a little bit about this at the time. "I came out of the theme park business," he said. "And so we tried to do all sorts of things. I wasn't really a hardcore baseball fan at the time. And I didn't really understand a lot of things that baseball fans do. Some of the things we tried, frankly, I just didn't know any better. 1983, we tried the Crew to Candlestick pins. And that sort of opened the door for fans to have a sense of humor about things."
Okay.
The two copywriters who were actually tasked with coming up with a pitch for new ideas are named John Crawford and Gary Freeman. And they came up with the crab idea, but they actually weren't hoping to sell it. They were doing a technique where you give the team two pitches, one crazy idea that no one's ever going to take and one that they expected that the client would select. I'm sorry that I don't have the info about what the idea was that was passed
on.
What the other one was. But the Giants are desperate for anything that they can sort of grab at to draw some audience. So they go, "You know what? We kind of like the crab. Give us the crab." So Crawford and Freeman decide they're going to go out and survey Giants fans. And what they find out from their surveys is that over 60% of the Giants audience will not cheer for a mascot. They're not interested.
Really? So,
this is why I love this story. I like these guys a lot, Crawford and Freeman. So they decide that they're going to play into this, and they plan to create a weird, ugly, anti-mascot that made fans of all the other teams angry when they would see it and would anger the audience. They're going to make an anti-mascot. They went out of their way to make the world's worst mascot.
When we asked Giants fans what kind of mascot they'd like, 63% said they didn't like mascots, which once again proves that Giants fans are different.
Hey, Frank, need any pinch hitters?
The guy who actually gets credit for this, though, it's kind of interesting, and I'm just going to get it out of the way now. I'm going to say his name. His name is Wayne Doba. I'm going to say it like Doba, like Doba Fett, as opposed to Daba, like Daba Chamberlain. Does that make sense? I'm going to go with Doba. Gotcha. I'm going with Doba here. All right. So Wayne Doba, interesting character. Wayne Doba is a trained dancer and physical comedian. He used to perform silently in a mask. He did this. He also studied mime and developed a pretty decent following while performing on the streets of San Francisco. He's a street performer. He's a professional mime. The most respected of all entertainers historically, right? I think it's like mime and then dramatic film actor and then magician and then television comedian. Yeah, right. His mask work though, actually in the 19, you know, at this time though, you know, being a street performer in San Francisco, this was getting him work. His mask work had already attracted Hollywood's attention. He appeared as the monster in the 1981 Tobe Hooper film, The Funhouse. And if you've never seen that, that's okay. But I do remember a very specific role that he was in 1983. Randall, have you ever seen the movie Scarface?
Absolutely, I have.
You need people like me so you can point your fingers and say, "That's the bad guy." So? What'll I make you? Good? You're not good. You just know how to hide.
Okay, remember the scene at the end of the movie where Tony's a big mess and he's in the club and Frank sends the people in to kill Tony Montana? And there's a clown dancing. There's a weird...
Yes.
Yeah. That's Octavio the Clown. If you ever wondered what the hell that is, you're like, why is there a weird clown performing in this club? That is Wayne Doba. That was based on a character he used to play in live shows. He says in later years that he does occasionally get autographs for either the Monster or Octavio the Clown, but he gets very few requests for the Crazy Crab. No one ever wants him. Yeah. When he booked this audition to get the Crazy Crab role, he said he wasn't even really a sports guy. He said, I was terrible at baseball and football and basketball. I could dance, but in terms of playing sports, there was nothing I could do. All right. So at the time, no one's really thinking about him as an in-stadium performer. And he was sort of hoping for that, right? This was simply a way to sell a few tickets and remind the San Francisco fans that baseball is back. Here's Gallagher talking about this again. To be honest, we had no intention of putting the costume out in the field. It was just a commercial we ran at the start of the season. After the first homestand, we put the commercial on the air, and people thought it was funny. So we figured we had this costume. People think it's kind of funny. Let's just put it on the field and see what happens.
From the very first game, it was clear that the Crazy Crab was, if not successful per se, at least having its intended effect. By the time it stepped foot, or claw, on the field, the extent of fans' loathing was palpable. The boos echoed throughout Candlestick Park, and a deluge of hot dogs rained down from above upon the unsuspecting arthropods.
So Doba gets in the costume. He's obscured behind this suit. I suggest, if you've never seen this suit before, and Randall, you too, you should take a look for it on the internet.
Yeah. I just looked it up, Sam, and I'm ashamed I haven't seen this before, and I so wish I saw it in person.
So this horrifying crustacean suit emerges from the bottom of the fifth inning on April 10th, 1984, when his theme song, his theme song plays for a minute and a half. I don't know what the theme song is. I'll find out. He starts dancing and jittering his way up and down the line before disappearing into the bowels of the stadium.
Wow.
Here's Doba talking about that. Because I'm a physical comedian, I was in the dance department, I'd done ballet and tap dancing, I learned how many moves I could do. Some of the mascots, like the Philly Fanatic, they could move their head, they can do all this stuff, but the crab is just a pancake, so you can't really make the mask do anything or speak. So I learned that I could stick my leg through the mouth, I could do the splits, I could do the moonwalk, I could pull the suit up and I could moon the audience. And that's pretty much all he could do. Those were his four moves. He did say one thing was always consistent. The fans absolutely hated him. Doba goes on to say, they brought me out on the field one day and there's about 10,000 people there. I'd never been on a baseball field. So I was like, wow. And immediately the fans start hating me and they are throwing objects at me almost from the get-go.
In order to express their displeasure, shocked even the most cynical of marketing executives. Golf balls zipped by its face, beer bottles sailed across the field, and batteries were flung from the upper deck. Opposing players got in on the action too, throwing rosin bags at the poor creature from the dugout. What certainly did not help was the increasingly obvious fact that in 1984, the Giants weren't just bad. They were the worst team the club had put out since the franchise moved to San Francisco in 1958.
To help out Doba, because this is actually kind of what the Giants want here. They sort of like this publicity. They decided to add a crash helmet and to add a little more structural support to the costume to help the crab keep its shape and also to protect Doba from the projectiles that were constantly being hurled at him. You're talking golf balls, baseballs, water balloons filled with urine. Later, he found out that people were going to the bathroom to fill up water balloons and saying, oh, yeah, we're going to hit that crab. Doba, for his credit, though, kind of gets it. He says, you know, listen, that's the job. You know, he was inside Candlestick Park about 75 times that year. He said, all the rest of the mascots out there are mascots. I am the only anti-mascot.
Yeah.
Not every moment is a downer for Crazy Crab, by the way. There are a few nice moments. He's invited to the All-Star game that the Giants hosted that summer. He bumps into Dwight Gooden while putting on his leggings in the weight room. He gets a high five while dancing on the field from his former classmate and then Mets third base coach Bobby Valentine. Of all the people in baseball who you could tell me would have been classmates with The Crazy Crab, Bobby Valentine makes the most sense. So much so, apparently, he remembered him so much so that Bobby Valentine said he had borrowed a suit coat from Dobo when they went to high school together.
That's hilarious. Do you think when Valentine was in costume hiding in the dugout, he got pointers from Dobo on how to pretend not to be Bobby Valentine? I don't know.
I'm kind of sad that Bobby Valentine didn't come out in the Crazy Crab costume as his disguise. That would have been hilarious.
That would have been hilarious.
So I put on the sunglasses. I had the T-shirt on. I pulled the hat that he threw kind of down a little low, and I went in the training room to see what it looked like. And I looked in the mirror, and I looked down, and I saw those stickers that you pull off and you put underneath your eyes on a sunny day, right? And I pulled one of them off, and I put it over here. And I pulled another one off, and put it over here. I looked in the mirror. I looked at them. They said, "They'll never know."
It wasn't just the fans and his supervisors who responded with anger, though. Famously, manager Frank Robinson yelled at Doba to, quote, "never, ever touch me again" during a game. Where things get a little rough for Doba, though, is the treatment he would receive from the opposing teams. Here's Doba talking a little bit about that. There's players along the way who don't like the idea of a mascot. Since the Giants had the worst record, some of them, like George Minton, were blaming me, the crab, for having the worst record in the league.
Okay.
So they would torment poor Doba. They would spit mint-flavored chewing tobacco into his costume, which had to be stored upside down. So when you would turn the costume up, all of the gross, disgusting tobacco goo would fall on you. Others would throw firecrackers at him. They would throw drinks in his face. This was mostly done in sort of a joking manner, but not always. The end of his career sort of starts coming here. Doba talks about this. He actually got tackled twice by players. He got tackled by Kevin Gross from Philadelphia, which was very playful. Didn't bother him. But then he got tackled by a San Diego Padres player who he doesn't remember the name of. I'd have to look up on the research if I can find. I'll look up a clip if I can find it. This San Diego player blindsides him from the back and throws his back out. This not only ends Doba's season, but also ends his mascoting career. He would later sue the Padres for the injuries and settle for a out-of-court settlement of $2,000.
Two Padres players blindsided the shellfish, slamming it to the ground with the level of force you would expect out of a pair of 200-pound professional athletes. Wayne Doba was injured and sidelined for the rest of the season, eventually settling out of court with the Padres in 1985 for $2,000.
Wait, I want to backtrack here, Sam. So Doba sues this guy, but he can't remember his name?
I think maybe
he just didn't want to say it.
I think maybe he didn't want to say it, right?
Okay.
I could probably do some light research here.
I don't remember who it was, but I sued him.
Maybe he sued the Padres as an organization.
Maybe. Right?
As for the identities of these assailants, it remained a mystery until 2015, when former Padre Kurt Bevacqua revealed that he had always possessed a lifelong hatred for crabs, as did his teammate and future Giants manager, Bruce Bochy.
These days, Doba is long removed from the costume past. He does still actually do things. They have a YouTube channel that he runs with his wife. They do like sort of vaudeville type things. Not necessarily my scene, by the way, but, you know, sure. I like that he's still doing his stuff.
It's too highbrow for you, Sam. That's way too highbrow.
It's a little too highbrow. It's true. All that vaudeville, baby. And it does seem, though, that in the more recent era, in the meta era that we live in today, the crab has gotten a little bit of a resurgence in terms of appreciation. Of course, all things do, right? There is an ESPN documentary directed by Colin Hanks about the Crazy Crab. The team has actually embraced him now. There is a second mascot for the San Francisco Giants, by the way. Did you know that? It's a seal named Lou Seal. Did you know that?
This is where the lovable anti-mascot comes in. Lou Seal was born on Farallon Island. He's a Bay Area native and one cool dude. He's universally beloved and a crowd favorite. A far cry from the anti-mascot formerly known as Crazy Crab.
Lucille,
that's hilarious. So again, in the recent years, you've seen bobbleheads and scarves and toys, and they've opened up a Crazy Crab sandwich station at the park. So they have sort of reclaimed the crab as something that they're if not proud of, that it's sort of become a sort of funny part of Giants history. Doba was rooting for the Giants during their most recent postseason's run, and he hasn't
really bitter that he hasn't heard from the team, even though he thinks his performance abilities deserve a bit more respect than he's probably been given. He has said, though, in the past that if the team were ever to ask him, he would happily turn into the Crazy Crab one more time and dance up and down the foul lines once again. I do like his sort of personality about this. He has said that he never had a problem being the most hated mascot in history. Sure. It's like playing a vampire in a movie or the bad guy. There's something about that that's actually fun to play.
Okay, fine. You either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
So there you are, folks. The quick and easy story of the San Francisco Crazy Crab, one of the ugliest and most hilarious mascots in sports history.
Now, I like the fact that Doba, who I just looked it up while you said that, he's willing to come back and play the crab. He's 73 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, he's an old man.
I can still do it.
I'm ready to go.
Let's go.
I just think that I didn't ever think we were ever going to have time to do a whole episode of the Crazy Crab. So I'm glad we got to talk about this.
Absolutely.
What's your opinion? You like a mascot, or do you think, or are you sort of over the idea of
it? When I was a kid, I absolutely loved the San Diego Chicken. Oh my!
Yeah, yeah.
God, are you kidding?
For sure.
He was the best mascot I'd ever seen. I had a stuffed San Diego Chicken. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
Stuffed animal
for sure.
Doll. So yeah. But beyond that, the minor league team by us used to be the Joliet Jackhammers, and they had a great mascot. Jammer, their new mascot. Now they're I'm not even gonna remember the name of the team. they're the Joliet Slammers.
The Slammers,
prison,
I see.
Because let's go with that prison theme. And the mascot is now J.L. Bird.
Oh, that's good. That's not bad. I like that.
It's
okay.
He's not quite as nice. But overall, I. You know, there's a few that are like the Philly Fanatic is pretty famous as a pretty good mascot, right? Do they call him Mr. Met, the baseball?
So it's funny you say that. I actually just looked up a list here. Bleacher Report had a list of the top. They ranked all of the Major League Baseball mascots. I'll give you your top five. Number five, Boston Red Sox mascot, Wally the Green Monster. Wally the Green Monster. He looks like Green Grimace, if we're being honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's good marketing. Number four. Oh, we talked about him last season. One of our favorites, Seattle Mariners, Mariner Moose. Number three, Milwaukee Brewers, Bernie Brewer. Just a guy with a mustache. Yeah.
Yep.
Number two, you were spot on, by the way, with 2-1. Number two, New York Mets, Mr. Met. And of course, number one, the Philly Fanatic, of course.
Yeah.
Do you think that Gritty has come in and taken the Philly Fanatic's like spot as the number one Philadelphia mascot?
No, Jalen, we're not here to pitch you a lifestyle. Gritty? What the hell is this? I thought you said Jalen Hurts came in here. Is he in one of the other stalls?
I don't know. I must have gotten them confused.
How do you confuse a young black man with a giant orange monster?
Okay, Gritty, picture yourself on a Caribbean island.
Don't pitch Gritty! Oh. We're here to talk to a celebrity. Gritty's just Gritty.
Probably. And it's funny that you mentioned Gritty just being a different sport, right? Because I feel like Gritty's hilarious. But I think the NBA mascots have taken it to a whole nother level. I think that's where the mascot game has gone, right?
The two that I think of the most, of course, are the Phoenix Suns gorilla, who's always doing the dunks.
Yeah.
And then, have you ever seen the clip? The Toronto Raptors have a version of their mascot that swallows the cheerleaders. It's like an inflatable one, and it will go and eat a cheerleader, and it's amazing.
Yeah. And the one in Denver, he does some crazy things.
Yeah, yeah, Denver mascot.
Yeah, and
he's like a mountain lion or something.
Those guys make like $500,000 a year to do that.
It's crazy. So
I think that's where the mascot game has gone.
I would be remiss if I didn't at least mention the only mascot who was worthy enough to get a spot tattooed forever on my arm. Of course, that is the Syracuse Orangeman, Otto the Orangeman, who is forever ingrained on my body. And I definitely don't regret that at all.
No, you shouldn't.
All
All right, man. I got to tell you, I had a lot of fun doing this episode. I liked the sort of weird little two-part episode that I sort of sprung on you without telling you. So thanks for being so flexible.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it goes really well together. So it was just what a happy accident, right?
Yeah. I had a great time with this one. But Randall, I've been thinking about it this whole time. I've been thinking about it this whole episode. Okay. I gotta know who the first mascot is. This crazy crab is bothering me. I know it's not him, but I've been thinking about this first mascot. Okay.
So in our first ever sports out of time trivia question, what is regarded as the first mascot in Major League Baseball?
I'm going to say the San Diego Chicken.
That's a great guess. And I think there's probably a lot of people who would have that guess. However, it is incorrect.
Oh.
That's okay. So, Sam, when I saw this question before I knew the answer, I was thinking San Diego Chicken as well, because he's an iconic mascot from yesteryear. So yeah. Here's the answer, folks. What is regarded as the first mascot of Major League Baseball? The first mascot in Major League Baseball to exist in live action form was Mr. Met.
Wow.
Right.
One of the best.
Now, he was introduced for the New York Mets when Shea Stadium opened in 1964. He's for those who don't know, he's a large anthropomorphic, however you say it, baseball head with a Mets cap and a uniform. He was also the first person on the Mets to be presented by a bobblehead doll. So yes. No other player had a bobblehead before Mr. Met. Now, he's also widely regarded as one of the most popular and iconic mascots in baseball history. There's a couple of facts that I don't know you know about Mr. Met. Did you know Mr. Met has a spouse?
Mrs. Met. I did know that.
Yeah, her name is Mrs. Met, formerly known as Lady Met. Okay. Now, she's the first female mascot in Major League Baseball history, and she debuted in 1975 and reappeared in 2013 after a long absence. Something happened in the marriage, I believe. So she wears a Mets dress and a matching cap and has a similar baseball head as her husband. She's very popular among Mets fans, apparently, and often flirts with other celebrities.
Yes. Yes.
So she's like your modern day Morgana in some sense. Now she and Mr. Met also have four children. Did you know this?
I didn't know this. I didn't know. I did not know about Mrs. Met and Mr. Met's children.
They have children who are all baseball headed mascots, as you would imagine. What else could they be? And they are a happy and loving family, I'm sure.
Of course. The
names of Mr. and Mrs. Met's children are not officially revealed by the Mets organization, but some fans have speculated that they are named after famous Mets players or landmarks. For example, some possible names for the Mr. and Mrs. Met's children, the Mets family, are Tommy, after Tom Seaver.
Yep,
he, of course, is a Hall of Fame pitcher who led the Mets to their first World Series and title in 1969.
Okay.
Keith, after Keith Hernandez. Yes.
Who does that guy think he is?
Gosh, should I kiss her goodnight?
Is he going to try and kiss me? I love Cajun cooking. Oh, this is getting awkward.
Well, good night.
Good night. Who does this guy think he is?
I'm Keith Hernandez.
He's the gold glove first baseman and team captain who helped the Mets win their second World Series in 1986. Shea, after Shea Stadium. That's the former home of the Mets from 1964 to 2008. And the reason why Mr. Met was conceived, was there for Shea Stadium. And City, which this one seems a stretch, after City Field, the current home of the Mets since 2009. Now, I don't know how old the Mets children are, but that one seems a little shaky, City. Don't you think?
That one feels forced. I like the other three, though. I'm glad Keith Hernandez made the list. I'll say I've been to Shea a couple times in my life before it closed down. I've never been to Citi Field, so I feel sort of bad saying anything about it because I never went to see anything. But Shea was like an awful experience. It was a terrible stadium. But it was charming in the way that terrible stadiums are charming, and in the way that, in my mind, old Yankee Stadium is still nicer than the new Yankee Stadium, because the new Yankee Stadium is new and fancy and feels like a museum, and old Yankee Stadium was a little bit grimy.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Now, I've actually never been to the new Yankee Stadium, so I can't really speak either. I've never been to Citi Field, but I've been to both Shea and old Yankee Stadium. I loved old Yankee Stadium.
Yeah.
Just because the history, and you just felt like you were on hallowed grounds. But Shea Stadium. I only went once to Shea Stadium, and it was a Mets opening day game, I believe, against the Phillies. And it was actually like, it was March 31st. And it was like 85 degrees out. So it was gorgeous. But yeah, it was not a great, you know, viewing experience.
Yeah, it's like anything else, right? When I go into Yankee Stadium now, and I went to, like, most recently, it looks like Yankee Stadium in there. It looks like the old stadium.
Yeah.
You sit down there, you look at it, and it's like, yeah, it's the same sort of vibe and dimension, but it just feels very sterile. The way that, like, almost everything feels very corporate and sterile these days. It just feels like a cleaner version of what used to exist, and that sort of loses a little bit of the charm for me when I go back to stadiums like that.
Yeah. So if we were going to suggest a new name for the fourth child instead of City. Now, the Mets had a pretty good run. What, 2015? They went to the World Series. Right?
Yeah.
Is there anyone on that team that you would name a mascot after?
My Mets fans are all going to be mad at me because
I'm
probably
missing
some. No, because I'm missing somebody probably obvious that, like, Mets fans I know love. Like, I know a lot of my Mets fans friends love, like, Jose Reyes. They hold him very close to their heart.
Sure.
Certainly David Wright. I know Pete Alonso. You could probably name one of those kids Pete immediately right now, and that would be totally fine.
That would be good.
But I would have to think, I'm trying to think, I don't know, like maybe someone a little bit less, like Piazza. Could you get a Mike Piazza in there?
That's actually a good one. Yeah, they went to the World Series.
Yeah, he had a bat thrown at him by Roger Clemens. Good stuff.
Yeah, yeah. No, there are some good options out there, but I think any of those would be better than City.
No, City's rough. City's no good. City's a bank. It's what he's naming it after, a corporate entity.
It's too corporate. Yeah. Anyway, that's the sports out of time trivia question.
I love that. That was great. And I'm glad that I didn't look it up because I was curious, but I was going to wait. I wanted you to tell me. I'm glad I didn't look it up. And that is kind of fascinating.
I appreciate that.
Well, you know what's funny, too? I say this all the time. Mr. Met is essentially a really boring mascot. He's a baseball. Of course he's a baseball. They're a baseball team. But for whatever reason, it works. The aesthetics are good. Because I want to say the Reds also have, like, a guy who has a baseball head, but it's not as charming.
Yeah, I think right.
Someone else does it, and it's not as good. It's like the NBA. Like, half of the NBA logos have a basketball in the logo.
Right.
And it's like, come on, guys. Think of something else. Anything.
We get it. We get it.
We understand that you play basketball. But before we close up, I had a question for you because I did some light research on my end on this. Did you guys, growing up, either like when you were in college or locally for teams that you support, did you guys have like local mascots around there in like Joliet in Chicago?
No, I'm trying to think. Neither. I can't think of any sports teams having a mascot when I was younger. I mean, obviously the Cubs have Clark now, and there's Tommy Hawk, and there's Benny the Bull, but I don't remember Benny the Bull being a thing back in the day. Why did you have one?
Oh, we had lots of them because we grew up because up here we had hockey teams. We had like all these hockey teams up here when we were kids. So we had what was then called the Utica Odd, which is now like the Adirondack Bank Center or the bank, whatever they call it. I still call it the Odd, right?
Sure.
So since we were kids, like, we had the Utica Devils, was the AHL affiliate for hockey here. So we would get like actual, you know, like Martin Brodeur played here and Scott Stevens when we were kids, right? Like,
right,
it was legit,
through.
Right?
Sure.
So, you know, that stadium was always called the Odd. So when they brought hockey back, when the Utica Comets, you know, brought sort of AHL hockey back, I forget what year that was, like 2000, mid 2000s probably. they had a mascot and he was called Audie. Audie, the, you know, he's the representative of the odd, right? He's just like a green sort of furry, like he almost has like a Grimace vibe to him. I don't want to speak ill of Audie. People liked him. But then recently the Devils got the affiliation back from Vancouver. So now the Utica Comets are the Devils affiliate. So now Audie has been transformed into Naughty and he's a devil, but he also kind of looks like Grimace. Nice. Now he's got horns and he's red. And then, of course, I have to shout out probably the most recognizable local mascot here. That is the Utica University, formerly Utica College mascot, Trax the Moose of the Utica Pioneers. Yeah, Trax the Moose all over the place. He's popping in everywhere.
Okay, very nice. Yeah. Well, our local minor league team, I think I mentioned this before, has J.L. Bird because they're the Joliet Slammers, right? And prior to that, they were the Joliet Jackhammers.
Yep.
And they had a really good mascot named Jammer. But yeah, that's...
What, was he a big jackhammer?
No, he was a big hammer. he had like a hammer, but he wouldn't... And he had like a round nose. He was actually kind of cute, but it was a weird mascot, but it worked. Supposedly, somebody at Disney helped them design it. I don't know if that's true or not, but you know.
What I always appreciate about Utica College is it broke the cycle that I had since I was a kid. I was only for my entire life two different mascots in elementary school, middle school, high school, college. I was either a Raider or a Hawk. And that was it. The only two things I ever was. And it wasn't until we got to Utica College that I got to be a Pioneer. And I was like, yes, something different. That's not Hawk or Raider. I'm so happy. Yeah.
Nice.
All right, Randall, this was fun. Next week, episode 5, we're going international for the Olympics, and we're going to look at Wilma Rudolph. So that should be a fun episode. I'm looking forward to that. But until then, folks, had a great time with you, Randall. Always a pleasure.